Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. The Case for Empathy, today on Advanced. Hello, listeners. Welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Peter. You are joining us here today, Thursday, February 26th, 2026, for the second day of our inspiration article for the month of February. It is called The Philosophy of Empathy. Empathy meaning the ability to understand other people's feelings and problems. The article asks, is empathy a core strength? Here's what philosophy says. And so yesterday in day one, we began with Elon Musk's now somewhat notorious statement, notorious meaning famous in a bad way, that he made on a podcast last year, that empathy was the fundamental weakness of Western civilization. Big sweeping statement about empathy being, in Elon Musk's mind, the fundamental weakness of Western civilization. And we read in our article yesterday how it is true that empathy, the ability to understand other people's feelings and problems, can make you weak, can make individual people weaker. There's this thing called empathy fatigue, which is a major source of burnout among people like counselors, nurses, doctors, surgeons, who work with people who are suffering, who are distressed, who are experiencing negative feelings. And that takes its toll. That is not easy to do day in and day out. And this is also something that yesterday's article told us about, the philosophical roots of skepticism about empathy. Skepticism meaning doubt or uncertainty about a statement or a claim as being true or as being good. And philosophers, ever since the ancient Greeks, not all of them necessarily, but the idea that empathy might be more of a weakness than a strength has been presented by philosophers for millennia, for multiple thousands of years, because of the way empathy involves negative feelings. To empathize with someone who is suffering means that you suffer a little bit too, just knowing that they're suffering. You sort of enter into that suffering with them. If they've broken their leg, it's not like you have now a broken leg, but you do have negative feelings because they have negative feelings, and that's what empathy involves. And so in today's article, we will hear more about the case for empathy, why, in spite of its difficulty, in spite of its challenge, the authors believe that it is a core strength, a mental strength that should be cultivated. And we'll also give you a chance to practice your English along the way, talk about the challenging vocab words in our article. And by we, of course, I do mean myself and my co-panelist coming back for day two from yesterday. Please welcome back to the studio, Rhonda. Hello, Rhonda.
Hello, Peter. And this is a very challenging topic. I've been thinking a lot about it since we talked yesterday, and I'm looking forward to diving in with our readers. And I hope we together can understand some of the English that might be a little bit confusing. These are deep thoughts with expressed in some very beautiful but maybe complicated English sentence patterns.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm glad to have Rhonda here to help us, keep us from getting too abstract, which is something that can happen. But we might even call it a weakness. But speaking of weaknesses, Rhonda, Elon Musk thinks that empathy is the fundamental weakness of Western civilization. What do you think is the fundamental weakness of Western civilization, in 2 minutes or less?
Sure. First, to define Western civilization, we think of it as coming from the Greeks and Romans and across Europe and, of course, into the into the Americas as opposed to Eastern civilization. Western civilization changed when Christianity became the main religion across Europe, the European continent. So I want to just point that out, that Western civilization is a big term representing hundreds and thousands of years. So if we want to talk about Western civilization in modern times, I would say that moral relativism is a weakness. The idea that, which I think is very prominent now in I'll call it modern times, that the idea that individuals themselves can decide for themselves what is right and what is wrong. I call that, it's been called moral relativism. There's not one moral standard that's right for everybody.
They're all relative.
They're relative. Yeah. That it's whatever I think is right for me is right for me. And we see that playing out in pop culture. So that's something to think about for our readers, to think about the term moral relativism as being very much a part of modern Western culture.
Yes, yes. No, that's a good insight, Rhonda. I think I would agree with you there, and that certainly is something that you find much more in Western civilization than in, broadly speaking, than in Eastern civilization, where there is more trust of traditional values, traditional beliefs, where there is more of an idea that there is an objective sense of right and wrong, not just whatever benefits me is right and whatever doesn't benefit me is wrong, which is what moral relativism leads to, at least in the West. If everybody just says, well, I decide what's right and wrong, what's true and false, then eventually, you know, you have chaos, you know, because everyone will have a different idea or different enough so that you inevitably get confusion and chaos. But to work our way through the confusion and chaos, we are going to go into our article now and focus in specifically on empathy and understand why the authors of our article, at least, believe, contrary to Mr. Musk, that empathy is in fact a strength that should be cultivated. We'll read that today. Let's go into our first reading now.
Understanding knowledge. The answer for why one should see empathy as a strength starts with the key insight from a famous thought experiment by the Australian philosopher Frank Jackson. Imagine a scientist named Mary who has studied colors despite having lived her entire life in a black and white room. She knows all the facts about the spectrum distribution of light sources and vision science. She's read descriptions of the redness of roses and azaleas, but she's never seen color herself. Does Mary know everything about redness? Many epistemologists, people who study the nature of knowledge, argue that she does not. What Mary learns when she sees red for the first time is elusive. If she returns to her black and white room, never to see any colored objects again, her knowledge of the colors will likely diminish over time. To have a full, rich understanding of colors, one needs to experience them. Consider a variation on Jackson's thought experiment. Suppose Mary knows the facts about pain, but hasn't experienced it. As before, it would seem like her understanding of pain is incomplete.
So in our first section here, we met yesterday a couple philosophers in the history of philosophy. We met the Greek Stoic philosopher Epictetus and the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Today we meet an Australian philosopher in our first section here named Frank Jackson. And Rhonda, why are the authors of our article telling us about Frank Jackson?
Frank Jackson proposed a thought experiment. He wasn't using objects in a laboratory, but he put ideas out there. Imagine this situation. So here's the thought experiment. Imagine a scientist named Mary who is studying colors and has studied colors despite having lived her entire life in a black and white room. So that's the premise of this thought experiment.
And just to be clear, the reason we're focusing on Frank Jackson's thought experiment is because, for the authors of the article, this is the beginning of their case for understanding empathy as a strength. That based on this insight from Frank Jackson's thought experiment, they see a way to argue for the importance of empathy. So, go ahead, Rhonda. You were describing the thought experiment for us.
Thank you, and forgive me. I was whispering to myself because I had to reread, dear listeners, I had to reread that first sentence again. Peter, thank you for unpacking that. Okay, should we talk more about this experiment? So this imaginary scientist.
This is all make-believe.
And we're going to use present tense here. She knows all the facts about something called spectrum distribution of light sources and vision science. Let's look at what spectrum distribution is. That means the distribution of electromagnetic radiation according to frequency of wavelength and consisting of various sub-ranges, things you can and can't see, visible light or ultraviolet radiation. So we've got this scientist. She's a scientist who studies colors. Now, she's read descriptions of the redness of roses, azaleas, those beautiful flowers on bushes, many colors, we see them in the parks. But she's only lived her life in a black and white, so can she really understand redness, Peter?
Right. She's never actually seen color. She knows, she has all this book learning about it, we sometimes say, all this knowledge of it, but she's never actually experienced it.
Right.
And so the authors ask, does Mary know everything about redness? Many epistemologists, people who study the nature of knowledge, argue that she does not. Epistemologist, there's a big fat word that you really won't hear outside of philosophical discussions, but it's worth knowing. It has some value in knowing. Epistemologist is somebody who studies how we know what we know. I know this. I know that Rhonda is sitting on my right and there's no one sitting on my left, but how do I know that? I know it just from my eyes, from information of my five senses? I look over to my left, there's no one there. I look to my right, Rhonda is there. Or do I know it by logical deduction? Rhonda is the only person scheduled to be with me on the panel today. No one else is. Rhonda normally sits on my right. So if my eyes were closed right now, and I didn't have that source of information for my knowledge, I could still know that Rhonda is on my right and no one is on my left. Two different ways of getting that knowledge, either by logical deduction or rationalism, or by the evidence of my five senses, or at least just of my eyes, which is empirical or empiricism. And these are two major branches of philosophy that epistemologists study. So, relating this now to our article, epistemologists would say that Mary only has this head knowledge of color, of redness specifically. And so because she's never seen it, there is a crucial aspect, a crucial part of redness, the color red, that she does not know about. And so her knowledge of redness is incomplete, even though she's a color scientist, because she's never seen it. Again, in this imaginary world of our thought experiment, she lives in a room with no other colors than black and white. So then the next paragraph says, it imagines Mary leaving the room or somehow seeing red for the first time. And what does she learn there, Rhonda?
Well, it's elusive what she learns. Our sentence is, what Mary learns when she sees red for the first time is elusive. It's hard to really grasp and describe what she learns. If she returns to her black and white room, never to see anything red or other color again, her knowledge of the colors, says our writer, will likely diminish over time.
will become less, will decrease, to diminish over time. It goes on, to have a full, rich understanding of colors, one needs to experience them. So it's not that Mary knows nothing about colors. She knows a lot, maybe a lot more than some people do. But her understanding of color is incomplete if she has not experienced them. And then, perhaps you can see where the authors are going with this, they say, consider a variation on Jackson's thought experiment, Australian philosopher Frank Jackson. Let's twist it a little bit here. Let's say, suppose Mary knows the facts about pain, but hasn't experienced it. As before, as with the color red, it would seem like her understanding of pain is also incomplete.
In an English usage comment here, understanding and knowledge. Understanding, knowledge, and empathy go together in this article. We often say in English, well, you have head knowledge, but you don't really understand. We make a distinction in English. And so this thought experiment, the idea that there's a difference or a relationship, something we can probe and question between having some objective facts about something, knowledge, and really having an experiential, we're going to get to that word, understanding. So
yes.
Those are words you know, of course, as our advanced listeners, but understanding and knowledge, those subtle meanings of those words are coming into play in this article.
Right, right. And in both cases, we're basically talking about a richer, a fuller, a more complete understanding or knowledge of pain, at first of redness and the thought experiment, mm-hmm. but now of pain as we introduce that element into it. Okay, so this is, again, the authors are presenting this thought experiment with the scientist named Mary to help us understand, to make the case for empathy as a strength that we should grow and develop rather than a weakness, as Mr. Musk sees it, that we should avoid in some way. So let's get to the second half of their case for empathy by going into our second reading now, Appreciating Empathy. Let's go into that reading now.
Appreciating Empathy. People can become less familiar with pain and hardship during times when things are going well for them. All of us can temporarily lose the rich experiential grasp of what it is like to be distressed. So, when we consider the pain and suffering of others in the abstract and without directly feeling it, it is very much like trying to grasp the nature of redness while being personally acquainted only with a field of black and white. That is where empathy comes in. Through experiential simulation of another's feelings, empathy affords us a rich grasp of the distress that others feel. It affords us a more accurate understanding of others' experiences and emotions. Empathy is thus a form of knowledge that can be hard to bear, just as pain can be hard to bear. But that's precisely why empathy, properly cultivated, is a strength. Resisting empathy impairs our decision-making. It keeps us from understanding what's at stake.
Okay, so right at the beginning of our second section here, this first paragraph really gives us a nice summary of sort of the author's entire argument here, their entire case for empathy. Begins by saying that people can become less familiar with pain and hardship during times when things are going well for them. And Rhonda, specifically, what happens during when things are going well?
We temporarily lose the rich experiential grasp of what it's like to be upset or distressed. Let's look at those vocab words. Experiential means based on experience. So we lose knowing through experience what it's like to be distressed or very upset.
Right, because we are experiencing happiness
right.
at that moment
right.
or during those times in
yes.
terms of what our experience is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We often say, going back to my comments earlier about understanding versus knowledge, I might say, well, you have knowledge, but you don't have an experiential understanding. We might use those words together that way. You need an experiential understanding. You haven't gone through it like I have.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You haven't walked in my shoes one English expression. But yeah, when times are going well, we lose temporarily that sense of what it's like to be distressed. And most of us would, you know, think, hey, that sounds pretty good. I'd love to forget how it feels to be distressed or upset or any negative feelings. But the author's point is that decreases our knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it goes on to say, so when we consider the pain and suffering of others, well, when we do consider the pain and suffering of others in the abstract and without directly feeling it, it is like trying to grasp the nature of redness while being personally acquainted only with a field of black and white. So this is bringing in now the thought experiment to make the point that we are all like Mary. We are all living potentially in black and white rooms in which we may know about red and the other colors, but we are lacking in our deeper understanding of red if we don't see red. And with empathy, if times are good, then we are in our black and white room of goodness and good feelings and positivity. And we may know that negative things exist, negative feelings exist, distress, suffering, hardship, but we lose temporarily our deeper knowledge of negative things because we're not experiencing them. We don't have that experiential grasp of them. And second paragraph, that point is where empathy comes in. Rhonda, how does empathy come in at that point?
Well, you have to have an experiential simulation of another person's feelings. So simulation would be the activity that produces conditions which are similar to real ones. So it's not really saying pretend, but in a way it is saying like imagine or imagine you're having this experience. Through experiential simulation of another's feelings, empathy gives us or affords us.
Right. It's as simple as saying, you know, if someone you're with has broken their leg, you imagine what it must feel like to have a broken leg. And you won't get it perfectly, of course, because the only way you could get it perfectly is if your leg actually was broken too. But you can imagine enough of it. You can simulate enough of what it must feel like to have a broken leg to get enough of a sense of how that person whose leg actually is broken, how they must be feeling, a simulation.
And I would say too, Peter, that as far as English usage, we're not going to say experiential simulation. I feel like that's a very researchy sort of phrase there, experiential simulation. I feel like that's a rather unusual way to talk about trying to have empathy. What do you think?
Well, perhaps not in casual conversation, but experiential simulation, it's really just an adjective and a noun, experiential simulation. What kind of simulation? An experiential simulation. Sure. I mean, if you spend most of your day talking about how to make a better rice dish or something, you know, in the cooking realm, you might not use the phrase experiential simulation so often. But this is advanced, and we hold you listeners to a higher standard. We want to prepare you for more advanced English in your highways and byways of life so that if someone else, at least, uses the phrase experiential simulation, you can understand what they're talking about.
I think you might come upon it like in a laboratory situation. This experiment, in this experiment, they simulated a tornado. I haven't heard that word used very much, simulate. This is a simulation of. But it has to do more with something being experimented upon.
Well, if we have any passionate devotees of video games out there, they probably are familiar with video games that simulate, that present a simulation of flying an airplane captaining a ship at sea or of a soldier on a battlefield. Those are all simulations too.
I was just trying to understand how to simulate someone's feelings. So that's why this phrase struck me as unusual, simulation of another's feelings.
I agree that we might not use this wording very often in talking about another person's feelings. We might, in fact, use the word empathy or
That's
empathize.
Right. There you go.
You know? So
there
in
you
a
go.
Way, the authors are having to break down a useful word in order to give us a richer meaning of it. But that's their point, is that we want to have a richer meaning of ideas and words that we might take for granted without really knowing what we mean when we use those words or when someone else uses them. But anyway, it goes on to say that this experiential simulation of another's feelings, imagining how they must feel, gives us a rich grasp of the distress that others feel, which in turn gives us a more accurate understanding of others' experiences and emotions. Therefore, empathy, final paragraph here, is a form of knowledge that can be hard to bear, just as pain can be hard to bear. And that, you may remember from day one, was the complaint that Epictetus and Nietzsche had with empathy. It doesn't feel good. It's painful to empathize with someone. Again, someone who's just broken their leg, it won't be the same pain that they're feeling, but it will be more pain than you were feeling a moment ago before you met the person who had broken their leg. So the idea that this is a willful embrace of negative feelings, a willful embrace of pain, but that is, it goes on to say, precisely why empathy is a strength. Resisting empathy, they sort of make the case for it in the negative here. If we resist empathy, if we don't develop it, it impairs, it limits our decision-making. It keeps us from understanding what's at stake. At stake, a good idiom meaning that if something that you value very much is at stake, you will lose it if a plan or action is not successful. Something is at stake, it means something that you could lose if certain other things don't happen. And so that basic point here is that empathy is a strength because it gives us a fuller knowledge of a situation in which we need to make a decision. And knowledge is always good to have when we're making decisions, especially to take us all the way back to the beginning of day one, when we're talking about government policy, like immigration, for example. If I'm not an immigrant or if I've never immigrated anywhere, then I lack a full knowledge of the immigration experience, which could lead me to pass or to support immigration policies which hurt immigrants unnecessarily simply because I don't have the knowledge. Not because I'm a bad guy, not because I'm a bigot, not because I, you know, don't like immigrants, but simply because I lack the knowledge. I lack the empathy of the immigrant experience because I, you know, have decided that empathy is a weakness and that I must avoid it.
So I would say that we disagree with Elon Musk. We think that the lack of empathy is a weakness.
So we and the authors of this article, at
yes.
least. Yes, I think we can say that with safety. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this and have, you know, been given something to think about and at the very least a chance to practice your English. We invite you to join us next time when we will have a new article for you and new panelists. But for today, I'm Peter.
I'm Rhonda.
Saying bye-bye.
Bye-bye.